This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 167 was recorded on May 16th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Variant Perceptions' Simon White joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Simon says something's got to give here, and he thinks the U.S. dollar is the most likely character to take a fall as this story unfolds. We've adjusted the format of our new premium content to bring you new content on your Macro Voices feed every single weekday. The second episode of Macro Voices Energy Week was released on Wednesday, May 15th, to rave reviews from listeners, and we're releasing new All-Stars interviews almost every day of the week. So keep an eye on your Macro Voices feed for more exciting new content coming your way in upcoming weeks. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, as Patrick has prepared another of his famous chart books for extended equity market coverage.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the one thing we can say about the S&P 500 is that the volatility is back. I mean, we had a pretty ferocious rally off of that 2800 level. What's your thinking here on the S&P?
Well, Patrick, I'm not the slightest bit surprised that we've seen a full retrace from last Friday's gap down open. Like I said last week, this had bear trap written all over it. I think that the market was reacting to the sky is falling because of the whole situation with China and the United States and the trade negotiation. And I think there's a lot of theatrics that are going on here. There's probably more to it than meets the eye. So now what? Back to all-time highs? Well, certainly if a trade deal actually comes together, I think that's where we could be. Given the messaging we're seeing out of the White House, it sounds like it could be a while. So we'll see what happens. But I absolutely, positively still think that the market should be moving much lower. I see signs of recession coming and late cycle dynamics every place I look. But frankly, what the market is telling me is that it's not worried about the things that I think it should be worried about, at least not yet. Now, our good friend Brent Johnson has one of the most credible bullish arguments that I've heard yet. He thinks the market is headed much higher, but it's not because of stellar fundamentals. Think about the Jeff Snyder description, where Jeff actually corrected me on the air. I said, Jeff, you're a dollar bull. And he said, no, don't call me a dollar bull. I'm not bullish in the sense of thinking the dollar is very healthy. I just think that for a lot of artificial reasons, it's going to move higher relative to other currencies. Brent's in a similar place. He is describing some dynamics for why he thinks the stock market in the U.S. is going to outperform, perhaps dramatically, in coming months. I don't want to steal his thunder and describe his whole argument. His interview is coming up on Friday morning. That's tomorrow morning's All-Stars appearance on Friday the 17th of May. So be sure to check out Brent's All-Stars interview for a bullish view. I still think the market should be headed lower, but one thing's for sure is nobody's listening to me right now.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Now, the U.S. dollar looks like it's going to take another stab at breaking out of 98. Is this going to happen this time?
Well, the dollar chart still looks healthy to me. I'm still bullish on the dollar, but we need to see that honest-to-goodness breakout, that acceleration on heavy volume of upside price movement that really confirms the thesis that I have for where the dollar is headed. And I have to admit to being surprised that we haven't really seen it yet, and that causes me to want to at least re-examine my view. And frankly, I have re-examined it. I'm still bullish. But I do think that I haven't really seen what I was expecting. It's time to at least think about opposing views and try to weigh them. Well, look no further than today's feature interview with Simon White. Simon has the opposing view. He thinks the dollar is done here. So let's give a listen to that coming up in the feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil here, because getting at least a little bit of strength here today as we're recording. What's your take here on the next direction for oil?
Well, I think the big upside today is entirely about geopolitics outweighing what was actually yet another big inventory build. Normally, that would have been bearish, and of course, we're seeing the price go the opposite direction. Well, it's because of so many things going on, almost too many to mention, between the Saudi tanker attacks and everything else. We did the full geopolitical review on the second episode of Energy Week, which is free in your Macro Voices feed, so I'm not going to spend time now going over all of that. Listen to the Energy Show if you want the full details. Briefly, though, the EIA report, crude oil building 5.4 million barrels. Really big build on inventory, normally a very bearish signal. But as soon as that print came out, the market actually started moving higher. And I think the reason for that, at least initially, was as big as a 5.4 million barrel build on inventory is, it's not as big as 8.6 million barrels, which is the number that API, the private agency, published on Tuesday afternoon. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1.8 million barrels. Great big build at Cushing, Oklahoma. Gasoline drawing down 1.1 million barrels. And distillates building 84,000 barrels. So the tape action was up, particularly on RBOB gasoline. That was the one place where the inventory number was a bullish indication on top of all of the bullish geopolitical indications. In the case of crude oil, really the inventory numbers were very bearish, but it didn't matter. It was trumped by larger geopolitical forces in the market. Now, what not many people noticed is U.S. production ticked down again to 12.1 million barrels, down another 100,000 barrels. That's a second downtick in a row in as many weeks. And remember, these big 100,000 barrel at a time ticks, you know, the EIA is rounding everything to the nearest 100,000. Normally, it takes a few weeks to get to the next tick level. We're coming from 12.3, which was an all-time record for U.S. production just a few weeks ago. All of a sudden, we're only two ticks below that at 12.1. That's not long enough for it to be a trend yet, but boy, this is something to pay attention to because the rig count has been declining, and that's caused some people to say, okay, that's it. The shale boom is ending. You know, rig count's declining. It's not that economic anymore. Shale is going to be dramatically decreasing. U.S. production is going to crater from here and fall apart. Other people are saying, well, no way, that's not true. The U.S. production has gotten more efficient. They need fewer rigs thanks to pad drilling to produce and create even more wells. It's not going down, it's going up. Well, of course, the production data is what's going to tell us who's right. We haven't seen a big enough change for it to be a trend yet, but you definitely want to pay close attention to what happens to U.S. production in coming weeks. Imports, 7.6 million barrels per day. Exports, a massive 3.3 million barrels. That's 23 million barrels of U.S. oil exported on the week last week. What's really clear, Patrick, is the market wants to move higher as geopolitical issues escalate. Well, how much more escalation do we see? Of course, you got to watch the news feed for that. Time will tell, but it's very possible that we could be headed back up to take out that recent $66 high on WTI.
Okay, Eric, let's move on to gold, because at the start of the week, it looked like gold was going to attempt to break 1300 and potentially buck the dollar trend and actually give a go on the upside, but it's been fading off 1300. What's your take here on gold?
Well, gold is doing exactly precisely what I expected it to do. But wait, there are multiple explanations possible for what it's doing. Let's take what might be the most obvious explanation. You see a well-established downward price channel. As you hit the top of that channel, the resistance level, you see a breakout on heavy volume. Well, that's about as bullish of a technical indication as you can get. So expectations should be that what you see is that breakout. There's a little bit of a cool-off period. What usually happens on a breakout is the market will come back down and test what was previously resistance as support. And then when you test that support, it eventually moves much, much higher. So that could be what's happening. We're already back down to the trend line at about 1285, 1286. So per that logic, right here, right now at 1286, this is your buy signal. This is the moment at which, per that logic, you ought to be buying gold hand over fist, expecting this big breakout to continue. But that's not what I think is happening. The scenario number two is this is a fake break based entirely on people panicking over all of the China trade war headline news. So you have to understand that gold is not only a risk hedge in the sense of people worrying about big bad things going wrong in the world, but gold is also one of the tools used by wealthy corrupt Chinese to smuggle value out of the country because they have capital controls and you can't directly take the currency out. So I think that gold broke out for exactly the same reason that Bitcoin broke out. It's one of the tools that corrupt Chinese government officials use to smuggle money out of the country so they can buy high-end condos in Vancouver. I don't think it's going to last because I think that the breakout was based entirely on the sky is falling over the China trade war stuff. Now, if the sky really is falling and the U.S. is about to go to a shooting war with China over trade, well, then obviously both gold and Bitcoin are probably headed much higher. I don't think it's going to go down that way. I think it's a fake breakout. And I think when people realize there's a lot of theatrics and kabuki theater here, but it's not really as bad as the headlines might have made it sound, then I think that the price is going to collapse. And you know, Patrick, when you have a bullish technical analysis indication, like a breakout on heavy volume that later reverses and turns into a fake break, that becomes an extremely bearish indication. And Patrick, I think just maybe that that is exactly what's about to happen. We see a daily close below 1285, below that prior resistance line. We're back into the price channel, and it's a quick trip down to the bottom of the price channel, much lower. Time will tell. I could be wrong.
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yields because we hit 2.35 on the yield again before it did a quick little reversal earlier today. Where are yields going next in your mind?
Well, remember, folks, just a couple weeks ago when we retested 2.60 after the Fed surprised on the hawkish side, I said on this program, okay, look, folks, right here, right now, this is your opportunity to buy the dip for bonds. Buy this 2.60 because I think we're headed lower in yield. Well, sure enough, that was right. Now, I think we're still headed lower in yield from here, but we've just seen a really big move in a short time. Another pullback is quite possible. So I think you're maybe a little bit late to the party to be jumping in now at this point on the long bond trade. But, you know, if there's another test of 260, I'll be looking to buy. I think that we are headed lower in yields. And I think that when you see these brief spikes to higher yields, it's a buying opportunity for bonds for sure.
All right. Well, Eric, we've been getting rave reviews from our listeners who love the new content, both the new short form All-Stars interview and the new Energy Week show. Now, before we move on to the feature interview, please give us a quick update on your efforts to secure sponsorship for the new programming so that we can keep this free for our listeners.
Well, we're off to a fantastic start, but we still need your help, folks. I'm really committed to being selective and finding sponsors whose products and services our listeners might actually enjoy learning about. We've already said no thanks to a couple of sponsorship offers from companies whose services I felt were not a good fit for our audience. And we're finally starting to hear from some really good matches. For example, Patrick, just this morning I got an inquiry from a guy running a fintech company that puts investors in private companies in touch with accredited investors. Now, Patrick, that's a perfect example of something that fits our audience profile. Some of our audience might be very interested in that. Some might not care. But at least it's an appropriate service that matches our audience. It's not somebody pushing whole life insurance or variable annuities or whatever else it might be. So we're making progress, but we still need your help putting the word out. The only way we're going to find sponsors whose products and services are truly a good fit for our audience is with the help of that audience. So please think about who you could reach out to in your network to suggest that they consider sponsoring Macro Voices. We really need your help. But the biggest surprise for me was the number of people who actually expressed disappointment that we're steering away from a paid subscription business model. Quite a few listeners expressed frustration about this on Twitter, saying they were happy to pay for Macro Voices and had no objection to doing so, and wished that we would just start charging them for access to our programming. I guess, Patrick, I haven't been clear in the past, but we absolutely do very, very much need and appreciate your donations. That's the best way for listeners who value the content that we offer to supply the bridge funding that we need right now in order to keep bringing you more content while we're working to secure longer-term corporate sponsorship. We already got more than half a dozen $100-plus donations in the last week, and we tremendously appreciate our listeners' generosity. The money you donate now will help us to keep expanding the content even before we secure long-term sponsorship. So for those of you who love Macro Voices content and want to help, please use the donate button on macrovoices.com. Now, quite a few of you are still asking us why we haven't set up a Patreon page to accept donations. Look, folks, with all due respect to your generous intentions, the candid answer is because Patreon is not an intelligent way for us to accept donations. Patreon is designed to help people who don't already have a website capable of processing credit card transactions. They take an 8% fee off the top, and it's more than 10% by the time you add in their other fees. That makes perfect sense for people who can't process credit card donations on their own, but it makes no sense whatsoever to throw away 10% or more of your donation on transaction fees when you can use the donate button on our homepage at macrovoices.com to make your donation, which we will then receive in full. So if you're inclined to donate, thank you, but please do it with our existing donate button and understand that Patreon just isn't a sensible way for us to collect donations. It doesn't match our business model.
Well, thanks for the update, Eric. So this week's featured interview guest is Variant Perception Simon White. So Eric, why did we invite Simon back on the show?
Well, Patrick, something that's always impressed me about the Variant Perception guys is they're data-driven, they work from leading indicators, and they have excellent graphs and charts. So they're not just pitching a sentiment message about what they believe in. They're talking about what the data is showing them, and they back it up with the graphs and charts that show the data. And I think that's exactly what we need at a moment in markets when, frankly, there's a lot of sentiment that's running a little bit out of control in some cases. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what Simon has to say about this market.
All right. Well, Eric's interview with Simon White is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Variant Perception's Managing Director, Simon White. Simon's got a fantastic slide deck for us, as Variant Perception always does. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Download. Simon, before we dive into the equity market, I know you guys at Variant Perception have a slightly different way of approaching markets. So let's start by doing just a quick summary of the process that you use at Variant Perception to approach and analyze markets.
Sure. And thanks, Eric, and thanks for having me on the show again. So as you say, I think what we try and emphasize is it's not so much what you think, it's how you think is very important. So the slide deck you mentioned, we have a very quick diagram there that I think really covers it. So we're really trying to focus on leading economic indicators because they tell us where things are going, not where things have been. And we use these to forecast turning points. And through these turning points, we basically look at markets, but we look at markets through the prism of valuation, sentiment, and momentum. And there we try and look for the biggest mispricings to try and find the best trade ideas. So that's the really kind of succinct version. The aim is to really come up with actionable ideas and using leading economic data to try and find those ideas.
Let's go ahead and dive in then with that context to markets, U.S. equity, bond markets, and so forth. Give us the high-level overview. We've heard a number of different views on this program. Some people think we're just getting started here and have much higher to go. I think you may have a different view.
Sure. I think what we're looking at today really is we have 2019's really been a bit of a conundrum. 2018, it was equities that were pricing in a recession towards the end of the year. And then in 2019, it was the bond market that was pricing in a recession. Well, equities made one of the fastest recoveries that we've ever seen out of a bear market. And today, what we really have is that all of the main assets, equities, bonds, and the dollar, they're all up in a year. And that's something that's fairly unusual. And that kind of behavior is consistent with the US experiencing world-beating disinflationary growth. But the thing is, from our perch, we find next to no support for this in the data and in the economic leading indicators. So the first thing that we've been hitting upon this for some time now is that US growth is set to slow. So we have our main leading economic indicator for the US, and that's been turning down for some time now. Now that tries to give a 6-month lead on where we think growth is going to go in the US. And almost all inputs to that indicator have been contributing negatively. And if we look at just across the economy, we're seeing slowdowns in housing and autos, manufacturing, which are obviously, you know, fairly interest rate sensitive, and especially manufacturing, you know, that's kind of on the front line, if you like, for what's happening in the rest of the world. And we're also seeing tighter bank credit conditions as well. So I think there's a number of signs that suggest that we're sort of entering the beginning of the end of the credit cycle in the US. And the other thing to note is that this disinflationary part, we don't see inflation as kind of gone for good. We're definitely not fit into the camp of, you know, your inflationists, your deflationists, that kind of, you know, long-term kind of view in these things. I think you need to be more kind of practical and more cyclical. And the current lull in inflation, I think that was well telegraphed by leading indicators. You had the rise in the dollar and you had the fall in oil prices. But this lull is temporary, you know, and we expect to see inflation heading modestly higher this year and into next year.
Simon, I have a question for you about, you know, you say here on slide 4, something's got to give. And I certainly agree with you. I'm trying to figure out what, and I'm amazed that we've seen so much resilience in the stock market. As you say, Simon, the bond market is stretched at least as much as the stock market. And it makes me think about this view that a number of people have expressed that maybe what's going on is as other markets around the world are weakening, which they clearly are, maybe international investors are looking to U.S. stocks, not because they love the market, but because it's the lesser of evils. Do you think that's part of what's led to all this strength in the stock market, which has certainly caught me by surprise?
I think that could be something in the, certainly in the shorter term. I think that really the story for last year, which has kind of lingered on to this year, was the U.S. was, if you like, the main kind of growth cylinder, and that was outperforming the rest of the world. And, you know, what we're trying to do is really trying to obviously see where we think things are going. So we still think that's kind of like, that's yesterday's thing, and it's today's thing, but it's not really tomorrow's theme. And the reason behind that is, first of all, as I already mentioned, we're seeing this sort of slowdown in the US gather pace. Now, it's from a high level, but it is beginning to gather pace. It's becoming deeper, and it's becoming wider across the economy. But at the same time, our global leading indicators, so basically we try and track a number of economic and liquidity leading indicators that look across the globe. Now, they've been flagging a global slowdown since kind of, I would say, mid-2018. And what we started to see with these indicators is they began to bottom, the very beginnings of a bottom, and look like they're about to turn up. So I think really what the next thing is going to happen is you're basically going to get a rest of the world growth, if you like, is going to stop falling and begin recovering from a low level at the same time as US growth is beginning to gather pace. And that combination should lead to outperformance of rest of world versus the US in terms of equities. And that also is one of our, you know, our strongest things that we're looking at, makes the dollar rally very hard to continue. So we see the dollar as basically in a kind of topping process right now. And one of the reasons really for that, it being able to struggle to go significantly higher from here, is that kind of re-rotation back towards rest of world outperformance. It's not to say the rest of the world is going to be doing extremely well. It's very much a relative idea. And actually, when it comes to flows, actual flows, if you look at slide 5, the left-hand chart, we have the dollar index versus net portfolio inflows. This is using the Treasury data, and they've actually been turning down. And, you know, there's been a number of reasons for this, right? We have had the Fed has basically had this very significant pivot, and they have manufactured lower real interest rates. So you have lower real interest rates in the US, which at the margin should lead to less capital inflow. There's less attractive reasons for capital going in there. And the other thing really comes down to the rise in interest rates that we've already seen. So that's caused FX hedging costs to significantly rise. So one of the big parts of capital inflows is bonds, and bonds tend to be FX hedged. You know, you buy a bond generally for income, not for capital gain. So you need kind of stable income. Therefore, you tend to hedge the FX. But because the FX has become very expensive to hedge, the net pickup on essentially buying for Japanese, say, or European investors to buy US debt has been negative. So they've kind of largely left the market, or more so that they're certainly buying fewer US securities than they were before. Now, there has been some anecdotal stories of people basically throwing in the towel and buying unhedged. Now, not only is that probably, you know, a longer term recipe for disaster, it also means that when the unwind comes, you're going to have people that have unhedged positions that they need to sell, which will have an even more dramatic effect on the dollar and taking the dollar weaker.
Now, when markets slow down, everything we know historically about markets is that when the economy is slowing and moving toward recession, usually that means bond yields go down, bond prices go up. But we have a kind of different environment. Usually, when you're in those circumstances, bond prices are already kind of depressed, yields are pretty high, and there's lots of room for that money to move into the bond market. Is the money going into the bond market, even at these lofty levels and low interest rates that we're already at?
Again, the data doesn't support it. So going back to the chart I mentioned on slide 5, the left-hand side, that's net portfolio inflows. So portfolio inflows are equity and bond flows. So there has been some pickup lately. And as I say, that could potentially be unhedged flows. But there really is, a deterrent. The marginal buyer, basically, of U.S. debt up until about a couple of years ago was essentially foreign central banks. So they were the ones who were the marginal buyer of US debt, but they, by definition, don't hedge the positions. They're managing currency pegs, so they don't hedge the positions. Since the dollar started to rally, that took pressure off these guys to manage their pegs, and then the marginal buyer went to other foreign buyers, but not central banks, and these guys are sensitive to hedging costs. So, you know, I pick up bits of, if you like, anecdotal information. You see, oh, Japan's picked up, it's buying, you know, German banks are buying, whatever it might be. But often when you go in to look at the data, you see the pickup is actually very marginal. So there isn't really at the minute any significant inflows to the US, either through bonds or through equities. And I think that's another reason, as I say, keeping the lid on the dollar. There's certainly quite a few dollar bulls out there. Positioning, if you look at the speculative positioning and the commitment of traders report, people are net long the dollar against developed market FX. But we haven't had that follow through. We haven't had that follow through. And that one of the big impediments is the rise in LIBOR and the concomitant rise in hedging costs that have gone with it.
Okay, Simon. So as we move on to slide 6, what I'm struggling with, you're saying here that U.S. equities and bonds and the dollar have all been up. So if something's got to give, what do you think is going to give? Because we can't see stocks, bonds, and the dollar all continue to appreciate indefinitely. What's going to give and why is it going to give?
Yeah, as you say, it is a very unusual circumstance. So, you know, as I mentioned, I think that the dollar looks capped. Many different reasons why I can't see the dollar continuing much higher from here. Bonds are also overvalued on some measures. I mean, you have today, obviously, the latest trade tensions have pushed yields even lower. And now you have the 10-year is now a few basis points lower than the effective Fed funds rate. But, you know, we also see that bonds overvalued on our own fair value model. So if we go to slide 6 into the left-hand chart, what we've done there is we tried to build market-based inputs. So we have the dollar, gold, oil, the Fed funds target rate, and we also use speculative positioning to try and come up with a fair value for the 10-year yield. Now, it's not really a prediction of where we think the actual 10-year yield will go, but the information content really comes is when you have a very wide gap between where the fair value is and where the actual yield is. And that's basically what we have today. And that really tells you what the direction of travel is going to be. So, you know, from that perspective, US bonds look overvalued. But is it in the shorter term, we have these trade tensions that are driving bonds higher. And also, if you look at the seasonals for bonds are very positive over the summer. So I think bonds could continue to stay supported in the short term. When it comes to equities, now, the inflation outlook, as I mentioned earlier, we think inflation is going to pick back up soon. And that also makes it hard for us to justify much higher equity valuations. So if we look at the middle chart in slide six, there's something called the rule of 20. And that basically says that 20 minus the inflation rate should be the sort of fair value for the S&P PE ratio. But, you know, rising inflation should mean that that multiple is based are biased slightly lower. So again, if you look at longer term relationships between the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, it tends to fall as inflation rises. So, you know, in many different ways, I think we see equities as kind of at best fairly valued. So the PE multiple is probably biased lower. At best, it will probably stagnate. Also, earnings. We see many sort of headwinds for earnings. You know, our wages leading indicator points to higher wages over the rest of this year. That's going to be a real problem for earnings. You can also look at, for instance, just simple relationships such as the ISM new orders. When that tends to go lower as it is today from the manufacturing report, that tends to be a headwind for earnings. So, you know, it's really difficult for us to justify where equities are today, but, you know, momentum obviously can carry stuff forward, although in the short term we are seeing, you know, obviously some kind of flux here. So overall, we basically need to see either a big change in our leading economic indicators, or we need to see like equities, bonds, or the dollar, one of them sort of beginning to sell off. And that basically is something that we're looking at today. So I think overall, I think it's the dollar is the one that's probably the most vulnerable. And that's because we can attack that from many different angles. And we can see from a flow perspective, from a growth differential perspective, and from a hedging perspective, it looks to be the more overvalued. But that's not to say it's going to sell off significantly. I think it's going to be a modest sell-off. Whereas bonds, I think, can carry on rallying in the short term. And as I say, equities, you have so many people that are still potentially offside. You have the potential for a quicker recovery there.
Simon, something that's fascinated me about the people I've had on the program who think the dollar is moving higher is they don't want to be called dollar bulls because they're not bullish the U.S. economy. They're not bullish the U.S. dollar as thinking it's the greatest, strongest, most wonderful currency ever. They're saying they think there is a international dollar short squeeze, that there is a demand for dollars on international markets that's not being satisfied, and that is artificially creating this move higher in the dollar. So give me a little bit more perspective on the reasons that obviously you guys don't see it that way. You think the dollar has plenty of room to move lower here, even in the face of that international squeeze in dollar liquidity. I know Variant Perception does a huge amount of analysis on liquidity specifically, so you guys have to be looking at this. How do you juggle the importance of dollar liquidity versus actual dollar fundamentals?
I think that's a very good question. And again, it comes down to, I guess, how we look at inflation. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you tend to have people that are inflationists and deflationists, and then tend to kind of pick and choose the sort of data points that suit whatever view they have. You know, we always try and be much more data driven and much more agnostic. And when it comes to the dollar, you know, I certainly would never classify us or you know, as being dollar bulls or dollar bears. It's very much a cyclical thing. But the other thing that you mentioned is always a structural part of the dollar market. And that is the fact that there is a very large structural short. So in times of heightened kind of macro tension, if you like, there will always be a need for dollars. You know, you have this huge amount of offshore dollar liquidity. So if you look at basically the amount of offshore dollar credit, so that's debt and loans, it used to be something of the margin of about $3 trillion, maybe 15 years ago. It's now close to like $10 trillion. So you have this huge overhang, if you like, that anytime any kind of the economy, or certainly from a global economy perspective, like we're seeing today with the trade negotiations, hits the buffers, there's always this natural kind of scurry for dollars. And it's the same, I guess. It's like, you know, my views or your views or anyone's views in the economy are basically subject to the proviso that, of course, this would all be different if the economy went into recession. We try and obviously predict when recessions are, and that's something we've obviously done a lot of work on. But the same thing with the dollar. So obviously, you know, if we hit like the had a global kind of macro kind of upheaval, say on the back of the trade war really spiraling out of control, then of course the dollar is going to rise. But outside of that structural thing, the cyclical thing's keeping it capped right now, and I think that's why it's struggling to rally, is this rotation back away from the US towards the rest of the world. And that will mean that the dollar will struggle to rally. Real rate differentials are beginning to favor the rest of the world. And if you look at the gap between rest of world growth and US growth, it's very large. And it's at the point where it'll start to rotate the other way, and it starts to take the dollar with it as it goes down.
Let's move on to slide 7, because something that I don't think got enough press really is the Fed in the past has primarily used the Fed funds rate as their primary policy adjustment tool. But they recently made a small cut to the interest paid on excess reserves. Why did they do that? What does it mean? And how does it fit into the overall story of what's going on here?
So I think this is very interesting. And as you say, it kind of maybe got slightly overlooked, even by Powell himself. You know, he dismissed the cut as a small technical adjustment. But I think it's really much, much more than that. And that's why it's really worth understanding a little bit more. And it really gets to the heart, I think, of a much sort of bigger theme, which is the growing tension between monetary policy and fiscal policy, and essentially the growing dominance of the latter over the former. In essence, you know, the Fed was basically forced to cut one of its main rates to appease the government. Right. So we know that Trump and the government have made it abundantly clear they don't like high rates. And even though that the main reason for this drift higher in rates, which was directly due to government policy. And what this really represents, if you think about it, this is a clear encroachment into monetary policy by the government, and certainly not just an insignificant adjustment. So I'll go into very briefly the sort of like the detail here. But I mean, there's much more to this, which I suggest that your listeners maybe look into a little bit more. But the chart we have there on slide 7, that shows the rate that the Fed cut, which is the interest on excess reserves. And that's basically the rate that's paid to eligible financial institutions who deposit reserves at the Fed in excess of reserve requirements. And the gist of it basically is that the interest on excess reserves, or the IOER, is supposed to police the top end of the Fed funds target range. And the overnight reverse repo rate is basically meant to be the bottom end of the Fed's target range. And the effective Fed funds rate is basically where the rate sets each day. So it's kind of a weighted average of all the trades. And that effective Fed funds rate is the one that was getting out of control. And it's the one that's basically supposed to trade under this IOER. And it started to trade much over it. And this is what really prompted the Fed to cut the IOER rate in early May from 240 to 235. And that's the first time they've ever done that outside a change to their main target rate. And where it gets interesting really is, why did this effective Fed funds rate start to trade higher? And the real reason was basically directly linked to the fiscal stimulus. Fiscal stimulus created this glut of bill issuance that caused bill yields to rise until they were higher than the Fed funds rate. And you can see that on the chart on the right in slide 7. That's something that's very unusual. And it really was mainly a consequence of this glut of bill issuance. And that really began to pull lenders away from the Fed funds market. You know, there's a number of different actors that are heavily involved in lending. And that's why we saw the effective Fed funds rate begin to drift higher.
Okay, why don't we move on, Simon, to slide 8. And how did this actually happen, this collateral gut from fiscal stimulus?
Well, yeah, basically the Treasury had been increasing issuance, as I said, and the primary dealers were being left with more and more inventory. So that's the chart on the left-hand side there. You can see that their inventory has risen very sharply. And, you know, this is because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the marginal buyer of US debt has moved from foreign central bank buyers who are managing FX pegs, who don't hedge, to other foreign buyers who do hedge. And you can see from the middle chart, as FX hedge costs have risen, so basically the rise in interest rates has caused a rise in LIBOR, it's become unattractive for many foreign buyers to buy US debt. And so the primary dealers are being lumbered with it. But they have to fund this. You know, they have these bloated balance sheets. They need to fund this in the repo market. And this dynamic is creating an acute demand for reserves, but it's not creating an acute shortage of them. So often, if you ever hear that there's a shortage of reserves in the system, that's not strictly true. And the reason why you're seeing this acute demand but not an acute shortage is because reserves are not distributed evenly in the system. And it's really one bank who has the lion's shares and the single biggest chunk of excess reserves. They have about 20%, and that's JP Morgan. And again, you can see this in action. Like, we're always trying to be data-driven here. You can see this in action, that basically when the repo rate trades above the IOER, the interest on excess reserves, this incentivizes banks like JP Morgan to lend their reserves out on repo to people who need reserves, like the primary dealers. There's also other people that are active in the reserve market, like the Federal Home Loan Banks, and they're also taking advantage of these higher repo rates. So the net effect is there's basically fewer reserves to lend out in the Fed funds market, and that's resulting in this effective Fed funds rate drifting above the interest in excess reserves, and that forcing the Fed to ultimately cut the rate. Now, it's been fairly successful. The effective Fed funds rate has come down to 238 from 245, but that's still 3 basis points above the new interest in excess reserves rate of 235. But really, as I say, the main sort of takeaway here is that you've basically had a situation where fiscal policy has caused interest rates to move up, and it's forced the Fed to cut rates when actually it wouldn't have wanted to do so otherwise. And as I say, that's a very significant baby step, but it's still a significant in terms of it's the direction of travel of, I think we're going to see more and more interference from governments into monetary policy.
Simon, let's move on to slide 10, lending conditions improving in the latest survey. What's going on there?
A very mild improvement. I think one of the reasons for the Fed's very significant pivot, I mean, it was very difficult to see exactly why they were so decisive when they would change course. But I think one of the things was in the Fed senior loan officer survey, which came out in early February for the 3 month previous period, we saw a very sharp fall in, you know, banks tightening their lending conditions. So the Fed, you know, responded to that. We obviously have been 3 months of the pivot. The new survey has come out and we've seen a marginal improvement, but it's not really a huge deal. And slightly more, I guess, concerning from the Fed's perspective is that loan demand has continued to fall. So if you look at the chart on the left-hand side of slide 10, you can see that sort of latest dynamic. And, you know, bank lending is very important to the economy. You know, if you look at the middle chart here, we can see that if we look at the net percentage of banks tightening their lending standards, that leads U.S. industrial production. So that's pointing to marginally lower U.S. industrial production over the next 6 months. And this really, as I say, ties into a broader mosaic of a number of things that we're looking at that show that the fact that the U.S. growth is beginning to slow. And, you know, we're always looking for multiple confirmation. And the other thing to note about lending is that when demand tends to fall for loans, as it is today, that tends to lead to lower loan growth. And you can see that in the chart on the right there. So as demand for loans fall, the supply of loans tends to fall 6 months later. And then if we go to slide 11, if we go to the next slide, the other implications for this is we're seeing basically a broad base kind of slowdown in credit. So, you know, we had a retail sales number was this week. It was disappointed again. I think that can be explained pretty well by this bank's willingness to make consumer loans. That's falling. And that tends to lead adjusted real retail sales. And another very important thing is one of the things that's kept the market so buoyant in the last few years has been buybacks. You know, you've had these massive buyback programs. It'll be very difficult to see these continuing in quite the same way when we're coming to the end of the credit cycle. So, you know, if you look at a look at chart basically of equity buybacks versus C&I lending, which is a proxy for credit conditions, you can see they correlate very well. So as the credit cycle comes to a close, if you like, we should expect to see much fewer buybacks, which, as I say, is a big support for the market likely to come out.
Simon, let's broaden this conversation internationally now, because we've been talking a lot about U.S. conditions. I think one of the biggest fears that people have is if China were to fall apart, boy, you know, the deflationary wave that that could send around the world could start the next big global financial crisis. And of course, with the U.S. trade war and the negotiations and so forth that are going on, it's led to a lot of heightened worry about the Chinese financial condition. But you're showing here on slide 12 that China's liquidity is actually improving slightly. What's going on here?
So we've been tracking this all the way through over the last year or two. And China, basically, the original reason for its kind of latest bout of tightening was to clamp down on the shadow finance sector. And in that aim, they've been very successful. If you look at basically claims on non-bank financial institutions, which is the kind of epicenter of shadow finance, it's collapsed. So in that end, they've been very successful. And why we've not then seen the normal kind of V-shaped recovery in liquidity and in Chinese growth is because they're very reluctant to kind of undo that good work. So all of the liquidity and easing measures that we've seen have been piecemeal. You know, we've seen cuts to the RRR. We've seen some interbank cuts. We've seen the buying of perpetual bonds. But again, all of these have been different to what we saw in 2016, which was what the Chinese refer to as flood-like stimulus. And they've been very explicit. They don't want to see flood-like stimulus again because, as I say, they don't want to go back and undo all the good work they've done. So we've never really were expecting a V-shaped recovery, but very lately, we began to see some response from some of the broader liquidity indicators. So one of the ones we track most closely is M1. And M1 finally began to look like it bottomed and turn up. So on slide 12 on the right-hand chart, you can see the black line. You can see that M1 has finally began to pick up. So we're beginning to see the sort of very kind of early signs of liquidity beginning to pick up in China. But the key message really is not to expect, as I say, a 2016 style V-shaped recovery. I still think that, you know, some people are believing that that's what we're going to see. And I think equities were trying to price that in too. But there's nothing that we see in the data that suggests that's going to happen. And that's really basically because it comes down to the Chinese credit system. It's very different from the Western credit system. I mean, credit is not awarded necessarily by need. It's awarded by patronage. And when credit's created, it tends to go into, you know, the state-owned enterprises. But they're not really the people that need it. The people that need it are the private companies. And they're not really seeing credit flow to them as they would normally under this sort of broad flood-like stimulus. So that's why we're going to have this much more stop-start recovery. And it's the recovery in China is going to be more U-shaped or L-shaped than V-shaped.
And how does the trade negotiation play into this? If all of these tariffs that have been threatened really do stay permanent and are placed in effect, I would think that that puts a damper on any sign of China turning a corner and moving back into a growth condition.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously another significant headwind. I mean, we're already kind of seeing this. You know, we try and stay away from making too many comments about geopolitical situations. But obviously, I think it's fair to assume that trade tensions is a severe kind of external headwind for China. And we're basically seeing that already reflected in our leading indicator. Our leading indicator for growth in China, as I say, has stopped falling, but it's not really turned up very sharply. But, you know, you don't even need to be a geopolitical expert or pass commentary on what you think exactly how these trade negotiations are going to unfold. I mean, anyone that can do that has a clairvoyancy that I don't have. But, you know, we can see already in the leading data that global exports are likely to fall. So one of the best leading indicators for global exports is what's happening in South Korea. South Korea is an excellent barometer for global trade, given its status as a small, open, export-oriented economy. And if you look at South Korean export growth, it's been falling for at least the last 6 months. And that leads global exports by about 6 months. So, you know, we have penciled in for China, as I say, at best a U-shaped recovery. Maybe it's an L-shaped recovery. Depending on the severity, of course, of these trade negotiations, that could make that outlook even slightly worse. But I think a lot of it's kind of baked into the cake already. As I say, you look at the leading data, it's already pointing to a slowdown in global exports. So I think we would need to see a real significant downturn from here for that not to have been priced into the economic data. But the main message is, you know, don't expect a quick recovery in China, and further trade tensions will only delay that recovery even more.
Okay, so tying all of this together from all of the subjects that we've discussed, as you've said, something's got to give. We've got U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, U.S. dollar all at seemingly scary high levels. Something's got to fall apart. And it sounds like one that you see is you think the dollar is topping out here. And the other view, it sounds like, is for quite a few years now, we've had a situation where the U.S. has been the cleanest dirty shirt in the pile. U.S. has its problems, but they're not nearly as bad as other developed market economies. And it sounds like you think that that is changing. And now it will be the U.S. underperforming other developed markets. Is that a fair summary? And I guess, where do emerging markets fit into that calculus?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. I think you're seeing this. The big theme is the rotation away from the US toward rest of world, which should mean that rest of world equities outperform in aggregate US equities. It also means that the dollar will struggle to rally much more and should sell off at least modestly. I think when it comes to emerging markets, there's very few markets that look cheaply valued. When I say cheaply valued in emerging markets, you need to look at not only things like their standard valuations, like, for instance, their CAPE, you need to look at their currency as well. And the only countries that look particularly cheap right now are ones that are still in flux. So things like Turkey and Argentina, you know, they do look cheap, and there may be some opportunities there. But given the outlook, certainly in the outlook right now with the heightened trade tensions, these are kind of very kind of high risk, potentially high reward trades. And we are looking for situations where we'd say we'd like to buy Turkey or we'd like to buy Argentina, but we do need to see a stabilization in the external accounts of these places. So for instance, you want to look at FX reserves. You need to see a stabilization in FX reserves. And you also preferably would like to see significant rate cuts after the big rate hikes. And we're not really seeing that in any of these emerging markets quite yet. You know, the macro environment is still has heightened risk attached to it. And that means that there's kind of no real easy pickings from our perspective, and certainly ones that are cheap in the emerging market sphere.
Simon, I know the charts and graphs that we've been looking at in this slide deck are representative of a lot of what you use in the reports that you publish. Now, for our listeners' benefit, Variant Perception is fairly protective over their intellectual property, so we're not able to send you any free samples of their reports, but it is possible, I believe, for our listeners to get a free trial of Variant Perception service so that you can see some of the research reports that they typically distribute. Simon, tell us a little bit more about what's on offer and where people can go to find out more about it.
Sure. So we have, as you say, we have a trial system. That's the best way, I guess, for people to really get to know our work. I think like a lot of economic research, you need to get familiar with it. So I recommend that. You can go to variantperception.com and see the page there for to sign up for a trial. We also have a new report called The Leading Edge, which is basically a light, easy to digest version of our main product, focused on the US with asset management recommendations. And there, if you we have a special offer for Macro Voice listeners. They go to variantperception.com/macrovoices. Listeners can get the first two issues free, and they can also sign up for the latest report.
Well, Simon, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Simon. I really do agree with at least the first statement they're making, that something's got to give. Like this idea that we have yields collapsing as bonds are running higher to the top end of the ranges, the dollar's at the top of the ranges, and the stock market's heading right back to their highs. That is an incredibly unnatural place for the markets to be. And one of these asset classes is going to give. And which one? I mean, I have my opinions, but I certainly agree that something in the next month or two is going to break in one of these groups, and it's going to be really interesting where that manifests itself.
Well, I agree, Patrick. I think something's got to give is a perfect metaphor for this market for all the reasons that you just described. And it definitely, you know, calls my attention to just really thinking through Simon's view, because I am still bullish on the U.S. dollar for all of Jeff Snyder's reasons for being bullish on it. But he's right. Something's got to give. So if you don't think that the stock market's about to collapse, and I don't, I think it should, but it doesn't seem to be happening. It seems like we're going in the other direction. And, you know, the bond market, we're moving lower in yield, higher in price. Well, if something's got to give, what's it going to be? I don't think it's the dollar, but boy, you know, process of elimination, that certainly is a good argument. So I'm going to continue to ponder this view. But meanwhile, I want to move on to your chart book. Listeners, you'll find the chart book download in your Research Roundup email. Or if you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, as I go into page 2 of your chart deck here, you told us last week, hey, if that 2800 support level holds, be ready for the springboard action to be vigorous to the upside. Well, that's exactly what's happened. Haven't quite taken out 2900, 100 S&P points higher yet, but we're close. So what comes next?
Well, you know, this is a really interesting moment in the market, because I think the way you described gold's rally is very relevant for the S&P here. So we hit a major support and we got the bounce. The bounce had quite a bit of velocity behind it. But is it a sustainable rally? One of the most important things is to see follow through and that the bulls are actually accumulating on that. Just like what you were talking about in the gold market in the at the start of the show, was that if the rally, after a rally like this, if the first thing that happens is they come in here on Friday and on Monday and they just hammer it and we give back the entire rise, that would be a really bad omen. And so, you know, I want to be really on tilt here, really want to see whether or not the bulls have enough in the tank to actually hold this gain, or whether the sellers are going to bring it right back. Any break below 2800 in my mind opens a bit of a air pocket floodgate, which could really drive liquidity selling on the downside. So I think it's going to be a very interesting week, to say the least.
Well, Patrick, I have to agree completely. You know, as much as I probably sound like a broken record with thinking that the market ought to be moving lower, it's pretty darn clear that the tape action is pretty strong here. And it feels to me like we're headed toward new all-time highs. And I would expect that when we get there, if we get there, that will become self-reinforcing. Buying will beget more buying. And before you know it, we'll be over 3,000. I don't think it makes any sense. But the more that I see, the more it feels like we're headed toward melt up, even though on a fundamental level, it doesn't make sense for me. Moving on to slide 3, Patrick, I see that you've chosen a picture of Jeff Gundlach expressly for the look on his face, which has written all over it, I want so badly to be on Macro Voices. Please, team, hook me up. I need an interview. I know that's what the guy is feeling. I can see it in his eyes. But you probably put this slide here for a different reason. So why Jeff Gundlach?
Well, you know, we talked about him last week, but from the equity perspective, but really I wanted to circle back to bonds and interest rates. And Jeff recently did his regular asset allocation webcast. So I grabbed a couple charts out of the chart deck to just speak to and just kind of get an idea of what were some of the things that were on his mind. And I wanted to have the conversation between us sort of on what my thinking is on it. So the first chart, of course, is that 45 degree angle line increase of the U.S. total public debt outstanding. And what's interesting about this is it's a compounding line. And what's interesting is that in that first decade, it doesn't matter whether it was a Democratic or a Republican president that was in office, you basically, in the first decade of 2000 to 2010, we had a doubling of the national debt. And then from 2010 till now, we've had another doubling of the national debt. And if we see in the next decade another doubling, then we're going to go from 20 to, let's say, $40 trillion of public debt outstanding. And it's an interesting trend that we're seeing develop in there. But obviously, the growth in outstanding debt is a big concern, because in chart 5, what Jeffrey Gundlach was showing was the CBO's projection as to the impact of interest payments as a percentage of GDP for the government, right? And it's this idea that if interest interest payments are going to be rising, it's going to have a larger and larger impact, obviously, on this. And this really begs the question, is this really where the crisis is? There's a lot of people that think that yields have to blow out on the upside because there's just too much debt out there. But after we had that great interview with Lacey Hunt and had Russell Napier on earlier in the year, I continue to be in that camp where I actually think that interest rates are heading down towards zero because it's the only way to make this debt sustainable. And we're going to continue to see this financial repression of managing these interest rates down to zero. We're all turning European and Japanese, right?
Well, and I can't resist but to just look to a longer time frame for a minute, Patrick, because not only do I agree with everything that you've just said, but, you know, you can't say forever, and I'm sure that Lacey Hunt would agree with this, you can't say forever that as there's too much debt, the result is that that debt always gets more valuable because there's too much of it. But if you think about it, lower interest rates, that's really what it means, is the value of the debt, which is the reciprocal of the interest rate, is increasing. Well, at some point, you get to the point where the market realizes it's completely unserviceable and it blows up and you have a crisis. And clearly, we're not there yet. Well, guess what? With all of this modern monetary theory stuff coming into vogue, you've got an increasing number of people who feel that increasing the national debt from $20 trillion, or $22 trillion as the case may be, to $44 trillion over the next 10 years is probably a really good idea. And, you know, over the next 10 years, is it then $88 trillion? When do you get to the point where too much debt doesn't mean lower interest rates anymore, and it means an utter collapse of value and through-the-roof interest rates? It's not until you hit that kind of third-world moment where everything's falling apart. I think we're still a long ways away from that. But if you adopt public policy based on modern monetary theory, and you think it's okay to just keep growing the national debt, I think someday you run into really serious problems.
Well, you know, Eric, the kind of bizarre thing is if you go and look back, let's say a couple decades ago when the national debt was $5 trillion, and at the time you suggested to people that it would double to $10 trillion, this was going to be a disaster. And that seemed as bizarre to people as someone today saying going from 22 to 44. It's a strange thing in compounding that we look at it, but I think that it can sustain much longer. I mean, eventually there's going to be the day that this is all going to come to roost. But, you know, I always say that to me, the vested interest of all parties, everyone has an incentive to kicking the can down the road and keep the existing system going. And I think under a period of financial repression, this can last much, much longer than most people think.
I agree completely, Patrick. Modern monetary theory gives us the tools that we need to spend the next 10 plus years sowing our ultimate fate. But the ultimate fate is not going to happen right away. And I think that in many ways, the trend is very much toward more openness to more debt. And I think that investors need to just take it to heart that we're going to have increasing debt levels for many years to come.
So on page 6, though, I wanted to talk about this. It was also one of the charts out of Jeff's chart book, and it shows the OMB's projection of borrowing from the public, from the government. And what I found fascinating here, and if I'm interpreting this right, is that this chart is suggesting that the primary deficit of the government would, by 2024, will approach zero. Is this real? I mean, is this real? I don't envision a balanced budget on this. I don't know whether I'm reading the chart right, but is that what you interpret when you see this as well?
Well, what I interpret when I see this chart, and we've heard this from other guests in the program, is that around 2024, you get to the point where U.S. tax receipts can only service the interest on the existing debt, 100% of tax receipts being consumed. So perhaps what they're driving this on is that's the point where you've completely run out of credit and you can't borrow any more in theory. Now, I think they will continue to borrow more, but no, I don't believe this. I'm sure that the chart is accurate that OMB really said that, but is the U.S. government suddenly by 2024 going to change its ways, stop deficit spending, and there's going to be a budget surplus, as this graph seems to be showing? I'll take the other side of that bet.
I'll take the other side as well. Anyway, so what I wanted to move on to is on chart 7 and talk about the euro-dollar spreads. And here I'm doing the spread between the June 2019 and June 2020, which often a lot of traders use as a way of forecasting what the euro-dollar markets are suggesting is the number of rate cuts we'll get in, let's say, the next 1 year. And we continue to hover around multi-year lows in terms of them anticipating as much as 2 rate cuts over the next year. And this goes back to the conversation we had with Simon, which is that something's got to give. The bond market and the money markets continue to point toward recession and cutting, and yet we have a stock market and a dollar that arguably are sending different messages. Which one do you believe? You think we're going to see these cuts? What's your over-under on this?
Oh, I think we're going to see cuts sooner or later, but I don't know what the timing is. And I think that it's going to be a game of chicken. I think the Fed is not going to panic nearly as quickly as the incumbent politicians would like them to panic. In other words, in an election year, what President Trump wants to see is for the Fed to just get accommodative starting yesterday, do whatever it takes, and just keep this economy going through the election. I think the Fed is in a very different position where they're sort of saying, okay, we know that when we have to cut, we're going to have to cut, and we've still got to have some room left to cut. So let's not start cutting before we have to, because we want to leave ourselves plenty of room to do the cutting when we need to do it. Let's hold out and not blow our wad, so to speak, before we have to. And I think that there's going to be a lot of contention between the Trump administration and the Fed. And as we know, President Trump is not shy about making his feelings known.
So, Eric, I want to move on, and I want to just look at the charts from pages 8 through 13 as a whole. And particularly starting off on pages 8 and 9, I have the yield curves, and I have the 5s 30s on page 8 and the 2s 10s on page 9. And really what they're showing, at least initially, is that the yield curves have really done nothing in the last 2-3 months. We've been pretty much pinned. Actually, I would argue for the 2s 10s, we've been pinned for a half a year in a little range. And what's interesting about that is that even though the yield curves have been pinned, we have seen, if you go look at the actual yields, an actual giving out of the tide on yields. Whether you're looking at the 2-year, the 5-year yield, the 10-year, or even the 30-year yield, all of them have more or less dropped about 80 basis points. And so we've seen a structural decline in yields right across the curve. So that it hasn't manifested in the curve changing shape much, but rather just yields right across the board declining. And whether you're bullish or bearish on bonds is one thing. But what I believe is a very realistic chance is that the fact that we've seen these 2-10s wind up the way they have on page 9, that we are very likely to see some sort of a big move in this yield curve, either higher or lower. And this has been winding up and something's going to give. The question is that has the little pop in the last month been the first shot across the bow, this idea that we're about to see a steepener kick in, particularly the steepener where we see the short end of the curve decline faster? And that would, in my mind, come back to the Charlie McElligott piece of Fear the Steepener. This idea that once the market starts pricing in those lower interest rates on the short end of the curve, and we see a steepening actually occurring, that actually will move asset managers away from those long duration assets, particularly growth and growth stocks, and move to far more defensive areas and higher yielding areas on the shorter end of the duration curve. And if we saw something like that, would that actually be truly the driver of the next major sell-off in the stock markets? And I think that watching this 2s 10s curve is going to be one of the most interesting things for the next month or so.
Patrick, I couldn't agree more. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that on Charlie McElligott's advice, I do have a curve steepener on the twos tens. And by the way, folks, Charlie has in one of his recent letters moved his recommended focus away from the fives thirties steepener in favor of the twos tens steepener. And Patrick, I do think that it's going to be a bull steepener. So in addition to being long the twos tens curve, I also have an additional position in 2-year treasuries. Long the 2-year, because I think that we are going to see a Fed rate cut. I don't know when, but when it does happen, it's going to hit the twos most immediately. And so I think there's plenty of upside in the ZT futures, which is the 2-year Treasury futures contract. And Patrick, as I move on to page 14, we're back to Options Education Day in Montreal. Give our listeners an update on what's going on there.
Yeah, last week I was letting our listeners know that the show's going on. If you're in the vicinity of Montreal and you can make it out for the Options Education Day, it's held by the TMX Exchange. It's a great one-day event. Breakfast and lunch are included on a $50 ticket with some great speakers, including myself, talking about options. So any of you can make it out. The information's on the site there or in the chart book anyway, for you to learn more.
Well, Patrick, it certainly is hard to beat a $50 Canadian event when that includes a free lunch and breakfast. About the only way to beat that is if something is completely free. And of course, the free offer is Big Picture Trading's 14-day complimentary access pass. No credit card required. So folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart books, you can get them 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, every single day on his webinars, and you can try that service for free. Just go to bigpicturetrading.com or send an email to contact@bigpicturetrading.com. On that note, we're going to leave it there for this episode, folks, but I'm going to change up our end of show and ask our listeners to please help us with a review on iTunes. As we are starting to look for sponsors for our premium content, those iTunes reviews are more important than ever. We've got a lot of really good ones on there, but a lot of them are older. So a new batch of fresh Yay for Macro Voices positive reviews on iTunes will go a long way to help us find the sponsorship that we need to continue bringing you even more new content in coming weeks. Patrick, the benefit of doing what I didn't ask them to do this week would be to receive our free research roundup email, thanks to registering your free account at macrovoices.com. See, I've got it in my blood. I can't get it out. What would they find in this week's research roundup?
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Simon's presentation and the charts we discussed in the post game afterwards. There's also an article from Seth Levine on the opportunity for misplaced inflation, and a link to another interview with Steve Eisman. This time he's talking about a U.S. recession would spur on massive corporate bond losses. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Sresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.